Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Kathleen Burke. Professor Burke is a professor emeritus at University College London. She is the author of a good number of well-received books, perhaps the best known being her biography of Alan Taylor, the historian, and her study on Anglo-American relations, Old World and New World. And today we are speaking about her newest book, The Lion and the Eagle, The Interaction of the British and the American Empires, 1784 to 1972. Welcome, Professor Burke.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Professor Burke, what exactly is the thesis of your book?
Well, it's in a sense. I mean, that's a normal question. I find it slightly difficult to narrow down, if you see what I mean. Essentially, it is the growth of the American Empire, how it was in conflict and cooperation with the British Empire, then the decline of the British Empire, and the rise of the American. But what I'm interested in, it's not a history of the United States, you know, British Empire or the American Empire. I'm interested in where they meet on the peripheries. That is to say, you know, where they actually do have territorial or at least interest conflicts. For example, the what is now the Canadian-American border. You know, for quite a long time, no one knew where it was, which meant that both sides could try to invade the other and so forth. Indeed, the Americans invaded Canada for a dozen times during the 19th century. But also, when you go out to the Far East, such as China and Japan, I was interested in how they reacted there together. That is to say, China, of course, broke open Great Britain, the British Empire broke open China, forced it to open itself up to trade. On the other hand, it's the Americans who essentially not broke open because there was no wars, but forced the Japanese to open up Japan to external trade, and in both cases, recognition of the equality of the Western nations to themselves. But in both these cases, they cooperated. Whereas, as I said before, for most of the time in the United States along the border, it was competition. And the final one is in the 20th century world, because there is competition there. You have an American empire, which is conscious of its power, but doesn't really want to go out and do much about it. British empire, which is conscious of its not lack of power, but of the number of other empires with which it was in conflict, such as France and the German Empire and the Russian Empire, and wanted to co-opt American power, at least get America to work together with it in areas such as the Far East, where as far as the British were concerned, the Americans had great interest and were in some danger, but they wouldn't accept it. The final conflict is really in the Middle East. After the Second World War, United States saw Britain as its one major Western ally. It was the only one after the Second World War from Europe, which still hadn't ever been invaded or conquered or occupied, and still had great faith in its own state, as well as still maintaining an international empire, the likes of which the world had never seen. But the difficulty is that this conflict centered on the Middle East because interests diverge. The British were concerned about their empire and therefore were concerned about growing nationalism. The Americans were concerned about Soviet empire and therefore were concerned, wanted to co-opt the growing middle class. I mean, this is very, very sort of short short sentences almost that don't really make clear the complications of all this. But essentially, the British fell under the blows of the Americans in the Suez Crisis 1956, and thereafter withdrew state by state from their African empires. The Americans didn't mind, but were they really minded is what, at the very end, when the British said, the late 60s, early 70s, we're withdrawing all of our forces, all of our bases, from what was called East of Suez. This is Singapore and Aden and Qatar. And the Americans, they very much didn't like it. They wanted to end the British Empire, but they didn't want to end the strategic advantages they got from all the British control of strategic places around the world and so forth. So in the end, you had an American empire, but no longer a British empire. And for a generation, the Americans, of course, were the only empire. This is clearly going to change now.
So in essence, the book discusses very different areas than was dealt with in your prior exploration of Anglo-American relations, New Old World, New World.
Well, that was interesting because I wanted to write, well, the term, awful term, holistic. I wanted to look at the whole relationship from 1497 when North America, when men from Bristol here in the UK first landed in North America to essentially March 2003 when the British became members of what then was known as the Coalition of the Willing in the Iraq War. In other words, I wanted to look at the whole area, you know, not only just politics and diplomacy and finance, but literary relationship and social things and cultural aspects. And but it got it. I was struck by one of the reviews, a very nice review in the Times Literary Supplement of London. But the reviewer said one thing she hasn't done is to pull out the imperial strand. And I had two responses to that. First of all, just how long a book did he want to read? Because that was quite a large book. And secondly, that I was tired of Anglo-American relations, and I went off and wrote a book on wine, as it happens. But that whole idea of the imperial strand kept niggling at my brain. And I started reading around, and I took advice. Had this ever been done before? An Anglo-American questions of the two empires? The answer came, no, it hadn't, and so I had to go. So what it does, even though the previous book certainly deals with the two world wars and so forth, it doesn't look, didn't have time to look at the questions of the two empires. In a sense, that's a slightly false distinction. When is the military power of an empire just the military power of the United States? When does it become American empire? I know that this is can be a dicey sort of debatable line. But what I was interested in was looking at outside Europe, essentially outside of Europe, outside of Latin America, areas where one hadn't paid much attention. And indeed, if you look at the number of books about Japanese politics in the 19th century in English, they don't actually litter the ground. So I must say I was most keen on the Japanese chapter. The learning curve was very high. And it was just utterly fascinating, and that if someone is only going to read one chapter of that book, have a go at that one because it will probably be the one that will produce the most new knowledge and the most interesting approaches of both the British and the American empires to a country in which they had varying amounts of interest in opening up.
Oh my goodness, Professor. I would think anyone who ventures to get your book would persevere and read the entire thing, not just one chapter. But let me ask you, what were the initial diplomatic issues between the UK and the USA in the immediate post-1783 period?
Well, the point of 1783 is when the United States, of course, becomes an independent state. And my argument was that it was an empire from the very beginning. If you look at definitions of empires, I know Americans on the whole don't like the idea of applying it to themselves, having just torn themselves away from an empire. But the point is here, you still had British North America, a.k.a. Canada, and a new nation, and neither knew where the other began or the other, you know, the other finished. Neither, it's not that they were immediately trying to grab land from each other. They had quite enough to do otherwise. But the first issue is how you actually define the line between these two empires. And that, in fact, that takes up a good part of till 1903. It's only in 1903 that the final parts, the American and Canadian or British North American boundaries are settled. It's a live issue. And as I said, conflict between the two, most people know about the Oregon Territory, but you know, between New Brunswick and Maine was a continuing conflict. That's where you had the Great Lumberjack War, for example, conflicts over the Niagara boundary, conflicts around the Great Lakes. If you control the Great Lakes and you have your ships on it, you can attack and invade the other country. What people forget, I think, is that the United States and Great Britain fought two wars, not only the Revolution, but of course the War of 1812. And this meant that in various parts, whoever controlled a river or who controlled the outlook of a block, do you see what I mean, could determine military strength, military success. And so the first real issue was defining an acceptance by both sides of where the countries actually were.
Why was exactly the Jay Treaty of 1795, first treaty between the independent United States and the United Kingdom, so unpopular in the USA?
Well, largely because the U.S. was convinced that it had given up more than it ought to have done. I mean, Jay said that his way from Washington home could be lit by all the effigies, you know, his body's being burned all the way through. It was so unpopular, as you said, that Washington only wanted to be dealt with in secret by the Senate. But of course, Washington was as leaky then as it is now, and the papers got hold of it. But essentially, because Americans thought it was their territory, this, you know, the decisions that had been made in terms of a boundary, and it oughtn't to belong to Britain. It was fundamentally other issues between them, such as impressment. That is to say, could the British take what they saw as British citizens off American merchant marines, and what is contraband? What types of goods the Americans were trying to export, especially during wartime? Could the British legitimately say was ought not to be shipped? All sorts of issues like that we have more or less forgotten about, but were great issues between a new country, the United States, that was trying to secure its own borders, its own security, and also its trading relationships against a power that was infinitely more powerful than it was. So the Jay Treaty did not solve a number of issues. It solved other issues, like where British forts were, and were they American or were they British? But what it left undone and had to be sorted out after the War of 1812 again was, where were all these borders? What was Canada? What was the United States? And that dominated probably the next 30 or 40 years.
What were the underlying diplomatic issues that caused the War of 1812? And why didn't diplomacy resolve these issues beforehand?
Well, the issues were essentially the impressment of American citizens by the British, and the American refusal to accept that. I mean, it's really, one thing is really interesting, that in fact bedeviled relations between the two of them, and it was really only settled after the War of 1812, is the Americans somehow thought that once they were out of the British Empire, nevertheless, they were going to be able to trade and to do other economic activities within the empire as though they were still members. In other words, the question of control of lands to dry your fish in Canada, which Americans thought was their right to do so, even though it was British imperial territory. The questions of whether you could trade with very rich areas of the, you know, Jamaica and the islands in the Caribbean. The thing is, the Americans needed economic access to the British Empire, but they did not like having to conform with British requirements because they thought they had the right to do it because they always had. It's very strange when you look back on it, the American assumption that what they wanted to do was what God intended, more or less. So the War of 1812 dealt with control of trade as much as anything. The reason diplomacy didn't work, partly was the Americans' own fault, because they thought that if they embargoed their trade to Britain, that somehow Britain was so dependent on the United States trade that they would give in. What happened, of course, is that under Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the America practically fell apart, with New England in revolt and federal laws being disobeyed and so forth and so on. But it turned around British control of certain areas of trade, which the Americans did not like to conform to, and the British impressment of American sailors, whom they claimed were British. They took them off American ships and put them on British warships. And essentially, they stumbled into war. Britain changed its economic rules. Of course, remember that it could take 3 months to get a ship across, so that people didn't really know what was happening. And once the British thought they'd changed, they thought once the Americans knew this, they would change and not go to war, and this didn't happen. Because the other aspect was in the West. Who controlled the Mississippi, for example? Was it going to be the British from Canada? Was it going to be the Americans? The Americans didn't like the British trying to set aside lands for the Indians, because they thought that should be American land if they wanted to settle it. And so you had the senators and congressmen in particular from the West with their own ideas from the South against various Indians in what is now Florida, in the North with trade. And essentially you had a whole different regional areas came together with their own ideas, and altogether it more or less pushed the United States into war.
You note that in the post-1815 period that American Anglophobia was not matched by British hatred of the United States or things American. Why not?
Well, the American Anglophobia, which you're quite right, dominated the 19th century in many areas of the country, although not all, not New England, for example. In a sense, it's habit, isn't it? Which needn't, and it takes something particular to break habits like that. The British was mixed. I mean, there were some people who were contemptuous of the United States because of their the way they acted, the ferocious bad nature of America and of politicians and of newspapers, for example, the fact that they seemed not to have any manners, the fact that they stole books, and essentially were incredibly nasty in both in speech and in press of Great Britain. On the other hand, the British, quite admired the United States. There were a lot of people in the United Kingdom, some of the working classes, for example, some of the more liberal politicians who watched the American experiment with hope that it would work. But on the other hand, mostly Britain just ignored the United States. They were devoted to Britain, for example. So they were questioned of whether the Civil War was going to work or not. Who was going to win was a matter of great interest to the United Kingdom. But on the whole, they were worried about, they had an empire they were building. The British had other things to think about. The Americans continued to see Britain as the great enemy, and therefore they tended to be suspicious of the British, whereas the British tended to be more often than not indifferent to the Americans. And of course, the Americans didn't like that either.
Do you agree with Professor Anthony Hopkins of Cambridge in his newest book, American Empire, that in the pre-Civil War period, the United States had a relationship vis-a-vis the UK, which would be best described as neocolonial in nature?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, not in terms of political control, but the United States during most of the 19th century was an economic colony of the United Kingdom. It depended on British financing just to get its southern cotton crop market. American railway shares were a dominant element of the City of London, financial stock exchanges, because they invested. The Americans partly were able to build their railways, especially in the earlier periods, because Great Britain loaned the money. They're in all sorts of economic areas. How do I put this? Great Britain was ahead in terms of inventiveness, in terms of how you do all sorts of things in terms of mechanical engineering. And indeed, Britain tried to stop certain types of craftsmen from leaving the UK to come to the United States because they were bringing over British techniques that the Americans didn't have. But fundamentally, yes, it's an economic colony during most of the 19th century, largely because British financial power from the City of London was responsible for financing an awful lot of things in the United States. Certainly in the West, a lot of the land was owned by the British, cattle ranches and so forth, and the Americans thought this was wrong, wrong, wrong. The other way, of course, it's a cultural colony as well. The American publishers tended not to publish American authors because they preferred to wait to hear things in the United Kingdom, how books were being received, and then pirate them, print them without permission. And indeed, a number of very famous American writers, various poets and so forth, were not published in America until they had their books favorably responded to in the United Kingdom. Indeed, how do I put this? Some Ezra Pound, for example, even at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, said that he was going to London, America's great cultural capital. In other words, they looked to the United Kingdom, both for economic help and for literary and cultural. Fashions in the United Kingdom were followed. All sorts of intellectual relationships. So yes, they still looked to the United Kingdom for many of these elements. This all changed in the 20th century, of course, but it was I agree with Tony Hopkins very much there. In fact, we march as one along that one.
How did British, as opposed to American, diplomacy differ vis-a-vis the Chinese Empire in the 19th century up to, say, the 1890s?
Well, the term used for American diplomacy vis-a-vis the British was referred to as piggyback or hitchhiking or jackal. That is to say, the Americans didn't really have any power. And during most of the 19th century, indeed, the State Department told the American diplomats they had to follow the British. The British had, their fleet on the China station was, of course, remember the Royal Navy was much the biggest, most powerful in the world. The Americans in Japan, they were lucky to have a ship a year call in. the American fleet until later in the 19th century was pathetically small. Remember that on the whole, Congress did not want to spend money on either a standing army or on a navy, partly because they saw it as a threat to the Republic. So when it came to abroad, until much later in the 19th century, they had to depend on Britain. Now, this is not necessarily the case with American merchants who were as red in tooth and claw as the British merchants were. And they certainly wish the Americans, American merchants certainly wish that their own governments would provide a lot more power behind them. But essentially, they had to, the British and the Americans out in China work together. And there's another reason for that, which is, neither the British nor the Americans wanted a political empire. They wanted economic access. They quite like economic domination, although Britain achieved this in the great Yangtze River Valley. The Americans never really did. But they didn't want to take political control. They didn't want the responsibility or spend the money or anything of that sort. And so they worked together against French Empire, Russian Empire, German Empire, Japanese Empire, to try to prevent their taking actual physical control of chunks of China. So they agreed on the predominance of economic interests, the desire not to have to include any sort of political domination, but also the willingness, if necessary, and here's mostly the British, to use force if necessary.
Now, how did that change in the 1890s up to, and I suppose, including the period covered by the John Hay's Open Door Notes?
Well, essentially, by that time, you had real conflict between all the great powers. Excuse me a minute. Which, in fact, it was called the China Question. By that time, there was such conflict. China, by that time, it was in the last days of the Qing Empire, and there were one or two extremely good politicians, Chinese politicians, Chinese leaders, who were good at playing them off again, you know, playing the various powers, and they hoped to have American backing on this, and it didn't particularly work. But what you had there was essentially China becoming a battleground, almost, between the various empires. But also you had a real huge Chinese Civil War going on at the same time, and which essentially the foreign powers got caught in. But you had what eventually became the Chinese Revolution by 1911. In other words, areas of China were out of control of the government, and it's a real maelstrom. And indeed, what you get, of course, in the late 1890s, the Boxer Rebellion, is rebellion against all the foreign missionaries, against their own royal family. And the Boxers, the righteous fists of the Boxers, thought that they had such power that they would be impervious to bullets. So you have China falling into a ferocious civil war, but also attacking foreign powers. And indeed, the Boxers attacked in Peking, attacked the foreign legations, not in Peking, port cities, attacked foreign legations, murdered the German ambassador and so forth. And you had the foreign powers then banding together and attacking the Chinese. So the 1890s are a period when it's difficult to see who is actually exercising power, because you had quite a lot of countries involved in trying to do this. And in this case, this is also a period when the Americans really do go for a military option. They work together, and in fact, they were some of the more ferocious of the fighters in the Boxer Rebellion against the Chinese.
Why did President Taft and his Secretary of State, Knox, dollar diplomacy fail so singularly in the case of China? And why do they view China in a different way than, say, Roosevelt and Root, who had a more realpolitik, if you want to use that expression, view of China?
Well, essentially, It depends on what elements of power you want to exercise. And they didn't want to send troops and so forth out into China. They wanted to work together with the British, but they were interested in trade. They, you know, the open door was meant to be, of course, open to all in terms of trade. And the other powers, France, Germany, Japan, wanted to make sure their own areas were closed. The other countries agreed with this, and then, of course, they all ignored it entirely. What Knox, in particular, as Secretary of State, tried to do was to use American financial power in the way the other great powers use their own financial power. Russia managed to come through Siberia and down into outskirts of China by financing railways. Japan tried to do the same by through Manchuria, by using financial power to get concessions from the Chinese government and to finance railways. And Knox thought that, A, you had this all this huge American financial power. Why didn't you get bankers like J.P. Morgan to come together and insist on having parts of all these concessions, railway concessions and various sorts? What Knox wanted to do was to use American financial power to break in to China and to exercise the power of a great power that he felt America deserved. The bankers thought this was awful. A, these various, this one particular railway financial agreement, which Knox wanted the Americans to barge into. The Americans thought, you know, this wasn't, you didn't do this. This wasn't the done thing. It wasn't their issue, and you don't go to other financiers with whom you have great relationships, such as the British, and say, right, here we are, we want a piece of the action. And essentially, it didn't work very well. They finally allowed the Americans to come in. And then President Wilson is elected, and he thinks this is just appalling. So after all the angst and the aggro and the work involved, he cancels any American part of it at all. So several years later, the other powers, the other find that after they made all these concessions to the Americans, the whole thing is canceled. So this was a real attempt by the state, by the American state, to use private financial power. This is not foreign aid. This is financial power as a weapon in foreign policy. And it was done so badly that it just failed. In fact, it was almost a laughingstock amongst bankers.
Would it be accurate to assert that the Americans played the role of the British opening up Japan, unquote, in the mid-19th century that the British played vis-a-vis the Chinese Empire?
Well, I think although it was done differently, certainly this was seen from the American terms. President Millard Fillmore and Commodore Matthew Perry decided, in fact, in about 1951, that they wanted to open up Japan. There are various reasons for this. First of all, Japan was a very closed society. It allowed no visitors. It didn't allow its own people to leave. They were subject to execution if they tried to leave the country. Japan was united, and it wanted to control not only its own territory, but its own culture. They had seen what had happened to China, and they didn't want this to happen. Now, America, during that whole period, of course, was still near whale oil. So there are thousands of American ships out shooting whales. And when storms came, they might be thrown into the North Pacific Sea of Japan, crash on the beach. And what did the Japanese do? They would not help them. They might hunt them down and kill them. And the Americans wanted this to stop. They wanted access to trade with Japan. They were driven out. You know, this is always very important. They wanted the idea of being able to use Japan as a stop across the Pacific on the way for trading with China, some place to refuel, to get more coal, to take on water. And also, Perry and President Fillmore consciously saw a breaking into Japan as a way to start taking over from Great Britain the control of the Pacific. Pacific Ocean was to be the American lake. So this was going to be the first blow in trying to break up British, what they saw as British control of the Far East. So it started with all sorts of reasons for it to happen. The British didn't mind. The British thought, gosh, well, the Americans want to do this, open it up to trade. That's great. We have enough to do in China. The Japanese possibilities weren't going to be on the same planet, financial and economic retaining. You know, after all, you had tea out of China and silks out of China. What did you have out of Japan? And the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Malmesbury, said, no, that's fine. And if it works, we'll take advantage of it. And indeed, it didn't take long till Britain had, in fact, the supreme position in Japan. But yes, America opened up Japan. Perry threatened to blow the place up, of course. But eventually, through negotiation, by 1858, it was agreed that there would be a council general, the first foreign minister or first foreign diplomatic representative in Japan. And shortly thereafter, there was a trade treaty agreed. But what also the Western powers wanted from China and from Japan was acknowledgement of their equality. China didn't think any of the Western powers, they were barbarians. That's what they were called. Japan, fairly close to the same thing. And the Western powers wanted to be accepted as diplomatic equals. It took a number of years before Japan would agree to allow any representation in Tokyo, Edo it was called then, because this was where Japanese center was, and no Westerners, no non-Japanese were to be allowed. But the other difference, which people sometimes forget between China and Japan with regard to foreign powers, and one reason that Japan was never occupied or have any political control by the Western powers, China was huge. It had something of an army, of course, but it was but much of the army was overwhelmed by opium and so forth. Japan, there were a 250,000 highly trained samurai. In other words, there was who hated foreigners. There was a defense force in Japan, which the Western powers with which it could not compete. So Japan managed to save its independence. It was forced to give in to what were called the unequal treaties, economic treaties, which only withdrawn in the 1890s, modified in the 1890s. But Japan, I think, is rather admirable in the way that it managed to keep itself together and keep its own political system, and its which became a parliamentary system by 1868, and its own culture. They took what they decided to do was open themselves up to the Western powers in a controlled manner, learn what they could in terms of military technology and Western industrial methods, and then shove them out. In the end, of course, what they did was to contain them.
Why did the British cabinet force Lord Salisbury to negotiate the Venezuelan boundary dispute when Salisbury's own inclinations were to ignore the American representation on behalf of the Venezuelans?
Well, essentially, I mean, I won't go into the whole background because I find it intensely interesting, but it's a little bit complicated, is that Venezuela was a lesser problem. That is to say, if you allow the negotiations and arbitration and so forth to go on with Venezuela, which the Americans saw as the British acknowledging their own control over the Western Hemisphere, the British by this time knew that the two countries, that is to say the United States and Great Britain, would never go to war. It would be like civil war. And because they agreed with the Americans in terms of economic openness and all the sorts of things which link the two countries together, they could let the Americans take care of it. That is to say, they could, if the Americans wanted to worry about the financial misconduct of various Latin American governments, fine, let them take care of it. That was now their responsibility. The other thing is, of course, is that by this time, which is 1895-96, Britain was feeling very threatened by the other great powers. The British, by 1889, the British had decided that the Royal Navy had to be larger than the next two threatening navies, which were France and Russia, because France and Russia were both imperial powers and against Britain in various areas. And if Britain did not control the sea lanes, they would be in real problems. Japan, by that time, had decided that it, too, was going to be a great power, a world power, and in order to do so, it said in its naval bill, it would build a navy equal to the greatest navy in the world. So essentially, what you had was a Great Britain that was in conflict with France in Africa, in conflict with Russia over India, because Russia was trying to come down towards India, in conflict in the Far East with Russia and India, Russia and France and Germany. And they feared that if they got in a European war and the United States backed the European powers, and there was no reason, and there was reason to think they might do, that Britain would lose. So what it had to do, and it began to do at that time, was to accommodate the United States in various areas, and Venezuela was just one of them. So essentially, it was the greater threat near the home islands from the European powers that forced Britain to accommodate the United States in Venezuela. As it happened, in fact, it was a question of who controlled what territory in Venezuela, whether it was a British colony or another area that Venezuela said belonged to them. And what happened is with the arbitration, most of the British claims were upheld. So at the end of the day, the Americans got to say, right, we did it. But Britain didn't lose particularly.
The League of Nations, which is viewed for the most part as a singularly American idea, was it not that, in fact, the case that Wilson, to some extent, derived the concept from his hero Gladstone's idea of the Concert of Europe?
Well, of course, it wasn't just Gladstone's idea. The Concert of Europe dated from the Congress of Vienna in 1815. Yes, Gladstone is one of those. The idea came as much from the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, who actually came up with the idea. The term League of Nations was a British title or name, and various of the British members of cabinet, Sir Robert Cecil, the most famous, spent a good deal of time putting together some of the ideas that Wilson then incorporated. In other words, it was Wilson's baby in that sense. But yes, the ideas of some sort of conventions. Remember the Hague Conventions, all these arbitration treaties in the 1890s and the early 1900s that said things should be settled by arbitration, not by war. There, in a sense, it was an idea of whose time had come. So Wilson was a man who believed strongly in it, but it wasn't just from Wilson. There were Dutch who were involved in this, for example. The idea of a Concert of Europe was an idea that sort of floated around in Europe, but it wasn't really happening particularly, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
And what the League of Nations brought, of course, was all for one and one for all, and collective security. In other words, we all fight if one of them, it's like NATO now, only it wasn't meant to be just a a military. In fact, the idea was that you wouldn't need to have a military response. I mean, the League of Nations, in fact, was much more important in terms of helping the new state from the Versailles Treaty get on their feet and find markets and set up banks and that sort of thing. Sort of the unknown work of the League actually was very successful, but the collective security aspect wasn't. And the problem with Wilson is he thought that the moral authority and public opinion would accomplish this. And as we could see very well, people weren't as nice as he hoped they would be.
How did the Great War impact or change the nature of Anglo-American relations?
You don't ask small questions, do you? Well, first of all, it brought the United States for the first time into what was fundamentally a European war. First time they had fought. I mean, they didn't fight very much. A skirmish or two and one battle in which they were on a quiet part of the line, but they had done their work in the First World War with all of the goods that they'd provided to the Allies. And in fact, the expectation of endless streams of Iowa farm boys to fight was as much as anything is what meant the Germans realized that once the U.S. was into the war, they didn't have any chance. One major thing was that because Great Britain was financing not only its own military and civilian populations, it was also guaranteeing or financing the same thing for the French and the Italians and the Belgians and the Russians and the Romanians and the Greeks, and it came close to bankrupting Britain. Now, the country which benefited, of course, was the United States. Not only were they selling all the goods that Britain was paying for everyone else, and then insisted that once they joined the war, they get repaid for all of this, hence the war debts. Britain also financed a great deal of American capital building. That's to say, all the factories which made the rifles that Britain needed, or the shell factories, or the aeroplane factories, Britain financed the building of great many of them, in fact, and as well as in Canada. So essentially, what happened is that because of the Great War, Britain lost its superior financial position, and the United States gained it. In other words, superior and inferior financial positions, they traded each other because of the war. And in fact, that hasn't changed. So partly this brought the United States temporarily into the idea of a great power. I don't think the United States was a great power during the 1920s. I think it was potential, but not an actual, because a great power needs both the resources for it, but also needs a sustained will. And the United States did not have a sustained will to power. It withdrew, in many respects, isolation from Europe in any case, although not from Latin America. So, and the other thing that it was very important is that during the 1920s, it was probably the most ferocious period of Anglo-American hostility, certainly in the 20th century, because the Americans decided that since they were now such a great power, they ought to have a great navy. And they thought at the same time there should be naval arms limitations. So what they wanted was for all the countries to limit their capital ships, in other words, limit battleships and so forth. And the British didn't mind in certain respects because they didn't have a lot of money to maintain what was by far the largest navy, in what had been the largest navy in the world, in fact still was. But they saw the Americans as a way of getting naval equality on the cheap. In other words, if you stop Britain building any ships, the Americans will then, of course, lever up as being the equivalent of the Royal Navy, if not anything else. And there was huge hostility. Indeed, there were comments by President Coolidge in 1927 that more or less threatened war. So, and indeed, it was the British, the Foreign Office, said that all the elements that all the factors that have existed during history that bring powers to war all existed, and that war between the United States and the United Kingdom was not unthinkable. So after what you got out of the Great War, not only is a great weakening of the United Kingdom and of course a great strengthening of the United States, but the beginning of sort of competition and some cooperation during the interwar period as Britain tried to maintain its position, the Americans didn't particularly try to expand, but they were not going to give any cooperation with Britain that might maintain their position or their empire. And it's only really by about 1943 that the United States emerges as the true superior in the relationship between the two. So the roots of the change in the British Empire and the relationship between the United States and Great Britain stems from the First World War. What the Second World War did was to confirm it.
You describe Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a, quote, Anglophobe, unquote. Why is that?
I don't remember saying that, but I certainly trust you on this one. What he disliked very much was the British Empire. He obviously felt a close relationship, Anglo-American relationship between the two countries. They were in terms of not only the language, but the political systems and so forth were the same. They aren't, but they were seen as more like each other than any two other countries. But Roosevelt very much disliked. He tried to making sure that Lend-Lease went straight to India, for example, rather than going through London. He did his best to lever India out of the British Empire, telling Churchill that he had some good ideas how to run India because the British obviously couldn't do it anymore. Churchill was a bit unhappy with this. Saying that to the British minister in 1941, I think, certainly during the war, saying that when you acquired Hong Kong in 1841, although it was 1842, but when you acquired Hong Kong in the 1840s, it wasn't by purchase, was it? This was a war with China, and the British official immediately responded, excuse me, Mr. President, wasn't that about the time of the Mexican War, where, of course, the United States had conquered what became 15% of the current United States? So there was a concerted push, in a sense, not precisely led by Roosevelt, but certainly backed by him, to try to break up the British Empire. And so he wasn't an Anglophobe as such, but he was certainly an imperialophobe.
You describe the UK as the, quote, primary ally, unquote, of the USA in the post-45 period up to 1956. Why would that be?
Why were they so close allies after that? When the United States had perceived Britain as a competitor during the previous centuries? Largely, from the two or three reasons. First of all, with the rise of the Soviet Union, with this new enemy in the East, it became quite clear that the United States was going to have an ally. It was going to be Great Britain. It had the British Empire, which had strategic control over a great number of areas of the world. And if Britain still occupied those territories, it was areas where the United States did not have to as they tried to contain the Soviet Union. Secondly, of course, it's the country, as I think I said earlier, that had survived the Second World War with not being occupied or invaded or conquered. The only European power in the war in which that could be the case. It still had a working economy, a working political system. So it was a strong, dependable ally. And they both had global outlooks, which Britain still retains, of course, that you don't look inwardly, you look out at the world. And British diplomatic expertise, Foreign Office used to be referred to as the Rolls Royce of foreign ministries around the world, they could depend on that. It was much better, certainly. Americans never particularly liked their State Department or diplomats. It was seen, in many respects, seen as cookie pushers and wasting time. Whereas in the United Kingdom, you have to be extremely clever and so forth to actually be a part of the Foreign Office, exams to pass and so forth. So Britain had a world outlook, diplomatic expertise, still quite a large navy and army, relatively speaking, and spoke English. and was the only dependable ally the United States could see. And it was the thing about in an alliance, both sides have to have things to contribute. Both sides have to be valued by the other side for what they contribute. And at that point, the United States very much valued what Great Britain, the British Empire, could contribute to not only international security, but to America's own security. I mean, one has to remember that if you're worried about the Soviet Union and you're America, NATO isn't there just to, as an American gift, just to, protect the Europeans themselves. Without Europe, America has no way, for example, of landing on the European continent. European relations have always been a big element in American security, as the Americans feared not only during the First World War, but certainly in the Second World War, and after the Second World War in particular. If America was the only democracy left, it would soon not be a democracy, it was feared, in the American government, because they would have to so militarize themselves to defend themselves that civil society, as they knew it, would disappear. So British role, in a sense, was to help the United States not only secure the international area in its own favor, but to secure American security as well.
Do you believe in the Suez Crisis of 1956 that the Americans would have accepted a fait accompli if the British had used force in a more effective and, I suppose, more importantly, quicker fashion?
Yes. I mean, certainly when John Foster Dulles was in hospital after the Suez Crisis and the British, one of the British, perhaps the ambassador, visited them. Foster Dulles said, "Why didn't you just continue going through and knock out Nasser? Why did you stop?" Well, of course, they stopped because the Americans not only cut off oil, but were allowing the pound to plummet. Without American help, the British would have, the economy, their currency was going to be in danger. What the Americans disliked as much as anything, they had in American diplomatic papers, you can find a conversation between John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, and the British Prime Minister, then Anthony Eden. And Dulles says, "Well, whatever you do, don't do it on the day of the presidential election." So what happens? They do it on the day of the presidential election. I mean, what was it about no that they didn't realize? In other words, it was much, I mean, the Americans didn't like Nasser either. They thought he was a danger, but they thought the British, and this was a culmination of their feelings about British activities and abilities in the Middle East, that the British were wrecking it, that they were doing it in ways that would make it even more difficult for the Americans to maintain their own dominant position in the Middle East. So yes, I think although the Americans said they wanted it peacefully, went through the United Nations and so forth, they understood why the British felt they had to maintain control, and the French, of course, and the Israelis, control, or at least not even control, a controlling overlook of the Suez Canal. This was the lifeline for Britain. It not only is where oil came through, but to get to Australia and New Zealand, other parts of the empire, you had to go through the Suez Canal. And losing control of that hit at the very center of British international power. And in terms of oil, British domestic security as well. The Americans understood this, but they sometimes felt the British did things in a way that was just a danger both to themselves and to American interests. And but it was quite clear if they had managed to go through and do it, the Americans would have accepted it. But the Americans put up barriers in a way that meant that Britain could not accomplish it.
Would you agree with those who argue that in November 1956, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Harold Macmillan, in essence, lost his head in terms of the seriousness of the economic and financial situation, and so misled his colleagues inadvertently or not deliberately, of course.
I don't think he lost his head in this sense. He could see what was happening to the pound, and he was letting the cabinet know where he was culpable. And what really, I do not like his activities in that position, I will tell you. First of all, he was one of the real, one of those who really pushed Suez. We've got to do this. We've got to stop Nasser. He encouraged. He was one of the forces behind the whole Suez attack. Then, of course, when he sees what's happening, then he tries to say, we can't do this, we've got to stop. And thirdly, then, he facilitates the removal of Anthony Eden as prime minister and his own substitution by working behind Eden's back with President Eisenhower. So I think this was not, to say the least, Macmillan's finest hour.
So you would agree with people like Scott Lucas, who argue that there was sort of a bit of skullduggery, for lack of a better expression, in the removal of Eden between Macmillan, Salisbury, and the American ambassador, Aldridge?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Scott is more ferocious about it than I might be. The thing is, Eden was ill. He'd had this gallbladder operation, and it had been badly done, and bile kept leaking into his blood, and he was on tablets, and he had, in many respects, his own officials wrote their diaries, and they thought Eden was going around the bend, quite frankly. So you could argue that this was seen as a way of helping Britain, of getting this man out of office, who was they saw as a danger to the British government. But this does not obviate the fact that it was a backroom decision by the American president, the American ambassador, and two dominant members of the British Conservative Party, one of whom was really going to benefit because he became the prime minister. I guess what I'm saying is that in politics, there's often no way that one can be proud of doing to get things done. Sometimes when the reasons of state are seen as more dominant than personal probity. And I think this is probably one of those times.
The sort of Bismarckian view of not laws being akin to making sausages, something that one shouldn't really view if you have a weak stomach.
Well, not at all times, no. But yes, I mean, Bismarck had his approach and little ways, but he certainly knew how to exercise power and when not to exercise power. It was once he left that Germany became a real danger, if you see what I mean. He was a man who believed in balance. So in that sense, I think sausages are probably irrelevant to this particular thing. It's just that, A, they thought that Eden had been a danger, they thought was a danger, and he had to be gotten rid of, and it could be justified because he was an ill man, I suppose. And, of course, the whole Suez crisis thing was, there's a photograph in my book, I think, that shows huge Trafalgar Square full of people arguing against Suez. It was almost as bad a crisis in dividing the British nation as Iraq was later. As Brexit is now, families breaking up over it, people not speaking to each other over it. It was a very bad time in British domestic and foreign policy. And some of these powerful members of the Conservative Party blamed Eden for a great part of it. His lack of judgment, his forging ahead when perhaps it might have been forged. And members of the Foreign Office on the day of Suez, many of them wore black armbands in mourning. They could see what was going to happen. Many of the members of the military forces did not want to do it, and they argued against it. But Eden drove it through, he didn't even have a full cabinet around him when he did it.
On the penultimate section of the book, you discuss the withdrawal by the UK of east of Suez. Could not it be argued that that decision by the Harold Wilson government in 1967 was in essence using the Sterling crisis of the same year as a political cover for a political rather than an economic decision?
Oh, It's a complicated. I mean, what one has to keep in mind is, for one thing, is to have a foreign policy or a military power policy, you need money. The British pound sterling, for 15 years had been having sterling crises virtually every year. Britain was existing on Bank of England was taking loans from other central banks, including from the Federal Bank, the Federal Reserve. And eventually, Wilson decided that you could not continue to exist hand-to-mouth on essentially short-term money. I mean, this was a difficult thing because it was during Vietnam War, of course, and President Johnson was putting ferocious pressure on the British government to become part, you know, to send troops to Vietnam. The British resisted this. A good part of the Labour Party, the backbenchers in, the members of the House of Commons, members of the Labour Party, 100 of them had signed a petition saying, "We will not support Britain joining the Vietnam War." America wanted Britain in the Vietnam War, and they wanted America east of Suez because they didn't want to be the only white power in the Vietnam War. They wanted. Johnson said, "All we wanted was, a platoon of bagpipers would have been enough. We just wanted the British flag out there next to the American flag." So, when the pound was under its final threats in 1967, the Americans offered to loan money, but only if Britain would go out what was called east of Suez, which included Singapore. And that's when the British said no, they couldn't. The financial position was just too dire. And so I don't think it was a cover. I think it was the final push. The British were already cutting back on military. They decided they were not going to be buying American jets because they just couldn't afford them. The Americans didn't accept this. They thought the British were not acting as the British ought to do. But at the same time, of course, in the United States, paying both for the Great Society and the Vietnam War caused America 3 years later to go off the gold standard. One reason the Americans didn't want Britain to what was called devalue the pound, in other words, the pound after November 1967 would only buy $2.40 and $2 of, and when before it had been $2.80. The reason they didn't want Britain to lower the value of the pound because they feared that once this had happened, all the speculators would turn and attack the American dollar. And, of course, this is what happened. So the Americans, the whole idea of 67, the devaluation, the financial crisis, and the devaluation of the pound was not a cover. It's just, you just can't, they could not afford the empire anymore. They couldn't afford hardly any foreign policy by that time. And indeed, the subsequent decade was a period of appalling financial mess in Great Britain. The Americans, in a sense, refused to accept this. They thought their financial power could keep Britain going as long as Britain accorded with the United States foreign policy imperatives.
If you wanted people, Professor, to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Well, I suppose the long relationship of the two powers, the fact that their relationship and the interactivity was a major element in the whole founding of the whole development of modern international history, that you can't understand international, world history, one might say, in the 19th and 20th, and now 20th centuries, without understanding how not only the conflict but the interrelationship of the power of the two was exercised. But at this time you also have to see what happens. It's unusual because Britain eventually was a declining power. America was a rising power. But this is the first time in history that the declining empire handed on consciously, torch of supreme power to the rising empire without about a war being fought between them. In other words, this is unusual, in fact, nearly unique. Well, you can't be nearly unique. Let's say unique in that the flow of power during this period and between these two was so supported by what they had in common, the fact that their empires were essentially white, the fact that they were private enterprise, not state-led, the fact of they were economically driven, the fact that they tried, although at least tried sometimes, to provide some benefits, although they sometimes thought foreign countries didn't appreciate how good they were. This is a unique period in international history because they were both dominant during their periods of time. What they said and did in many areas was the most important decisions taken, but also to take away the empire's end. And if you cannot pay for them, you don't have them. If you lose the will to empire, you're going to lose the empire. And we can take that away in thinking about current events, I think.
Thank you very much, Professor. I would like to thank you for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, the podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you again, Professor.
Thank you.